WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Michael J. Fox, stars in a new movie opening this weekend called For Love or Money. It's a romantic comedy directed by Barry Sonnenfeld, who also directed The Addams Family. Fox plays a concierge in a pricey New York hotel. He knows the city inside out, and for the right price, can get anything a guest could ask for. Fox is, of course, best known for his role as Alex Keaton on Family Ties and for the Back to the Future movies. I told him I really admired some of the choices he's made in his career. In addition to commercial comedies, he's done complex dramatic films like Brian De Palma's Casualties of War, set in Vietnam, and Paul Schrader's Light of Day, a movie about a brother-sister rock band co-starring Joan Jett.
I'm proud of those choices, and I'm proud of those movies. I wish that I could take credit for some kind of grand vision and say, well, yeah, you know, I felt it. It was good to have this juxtaposition, and well, I really didn't. I read scripts, and I said, wow, really? I can do this? You'll let me? Terrific.
Now, why do you think they sent you the scripts? Because you were known as a comic actor, and these were both dramas, and I know, like in Hollywood, there's so much typecasting. Why do you think they thought of you?
It's hard to get into the minds of other people.
Yeah, right.
Really,
probably especially in Hollywood, right?
Especially in Hollywood, and you don't even want to go there, and you don't want to go there alone. But I think there are a lot of different reasons, and a lot of people have different agendas. Sometimes it's purely commercial. People say, I would love to attach that name to my project, whatever its suitability, because it could bring a heightened return on my investment. I think that other people, have a pure belief in your ability and say, yeah, this guy can do it. And they want to be the person that bets on the winning horse. They want to be the person that's right, in that regard. And I think also some people are forced into it. And, some people, so any one
forced
of those...
Forced into it, like choose someone from the A-list?
Right, exactly. Yeah. And any one of those factions can be campaigning and lobbying. So as an actor, it does you no good in the long run to think about that.
I want to talk with you a little bit about your background. You grew up in Canada. Your father was in the Canadian Army, and then he was with the Edmonton Police?
Actually, the Delta Police in British Columbia. He was a dispatcher.
Oh, okay.
Which my father loved the police. He loved that lifestyle. He was too old to be an active policeman by the time he had finished his term in the service. But he used to say his job was to say, "Go get 'em, boys." He really loved that.
So was he a disciplinarian at home?
He was in many ways, and yet in other ways he gave you a lot of room. 1,700 hours, sit at the dinner table and don't be late and all that good stuff. But at the same time, this is a man who, when I was 17 years old, allowed me to drop out of high school because high school wouldn't give me room to do theater at night and to do the television work that I was doing. And my father's way of thinking was that from my socioeconomic background, it's not like I was going to the University of British Columbia and becoming a physiotherapist or a lawyer. I mean, that wasn't going to happen. So in his way of thinking, if I was happy and I had found a vocation that interested me and I was getting a check, that he would do everything he could to support me. And in fact, my father drove me down to Los Angeles on his credit card, picked up the gas and all that stuff.
You were how old when you got Family Ties?
I was 20 years old.
20?
Yeah.
So how'd you get the part?
Well, that was a long, involved story. I was at this point destitute. I mean, I had...
Destitute or in debt? You're in debt, right?
I was both, yeah. I had no phone. I had no furniture. I was ducking the landlord. I was eating plain wrap macaroni and tuna. And I owed the IRS some money. And I was in a tough spot. And I knew that at that point, it was time to go back to Canada. But I really felt that I could do something. And I said to my agent, because I had always resisted going in to read for sitcoms, but I said, at this point, I'm so desperate, I'll do anything. Send me in for sitcoms. Send me in for everything. And I went in and read for Family Ties. Gary Goldberg hated me, didn't want to see me again. Judith Wiener was insistent that he was missing the point with me. And after about 5 weeks, he had me come in again. And I read for him. Gary Goldberg is the executive producer. I read for him again, and immediately he became my champion. He took me to the network. He fought for me very hard because they were resistant. And then they hired me. We did the pilot. Brandon Tartikoff wanted to fire me again, said to Gary. And this was by Brandon's own admission. I didn't know this until several years later, and he kind of came to me and said, "You want to know what an idiot I am? This is what I was trying to do, and you didn't even know about it." He had approached Gary and said, "Look, the kid's all right, but can you see his face on a lunchbox?" And Gary said, "Well, you know, I'd never thought that that was, you know, the criterion for you know, hiring actors." He said, "Look, Brandon, all I know is I write the kid two jokes. He gets me three laughs. You can't take this kid away from me." And so they kept me around, and ultimately it paid off.
The show was, I think, supposed to be about the parents first, you know, the hippie parents in the 80s, you know, 20 years later in the 80s. But the show ended up being more about you and Justine Bateman. How can you feel, when did you start to feel that change happening?
Well, almost from the beginning. When we did the pilot for Family Ties, I saw, not in anything that I was doing, but I saw in the character, I just saw an energy and also a relevance and I don't know, of this weird accessibility that I don't think many people saw. I said, well, I know these guys. I mean, I hang out at UCLA and these guys exist, you know, much to my fear and my dread, that there was that wave, that whole Reagan youth thing starting to happen. And they had written a funny character, and they had written a lot of funny contradictions and a lot of ironies within this character. And so we did the pilot, and I kind of knew that he was, that if we went on, he would kind of start to move center stage. And it wasn't anything I was trying to manipulate or cause to happen. I just knew. And what I knew about writers was they will write to where the laughs are, and they will write for you know, the character that provides the most laughs. And and again, I wasn't trying to step forward and do that. I just kind of knew, and I would know every week, and I would step back and I'd go, damn. I mean, they howled at that stuff. And next week there'd be more lines and more lines, and it just kind of progressed from there.
Was it hard as you kept getting older for the character to still be at home and in high school? Because it took him a while to get to college.
Yeah, it was. You know, it was kind of weird at 27 to be saying, "Mallory, get off the phone." You know? it was getting old, and we all knew it, you know. And that was one of the reasons, you know, it was, we all decided in the seventh season that was it, you know, that we couldn't really do anymore, that it wasn't fair. You know, I kind of felt like we were just taking people for a ride if we'd gone much beyond that. You know, it was, to me, the peak season, the best season of Family Ties will always be the fifth season. For a lot of reasons, it was the season that my wife now came on the show, and it was.
This is Tracy Pollan.
Tracy Pollan, yeah, and I think, you know, that's just when it, you know, kind of kicked to another level, and also it was we were then in the full swing of the whole kind of Back to the Future, Cosby Show, this whole thing that was happening. We were in this great time slot, and I had this whole other thing happening with a film career, and it just got into this other energy where we just. It was like that championship season, you know. It was just the year that it was great. And after that, we were kind of, you know, I think we were still doing a quality show, but, you know, that was its moment.
So did you and Tracy Pollan start to fall in love on the set?
We actually didn't. We were both involved in different relationships. I had a crush on her. There's no question of that. I thought she was unbelievable and such a good actress. And it wasn't until I did Bright Lights, Big City, and she read for it. And we had this conversation, and I said, you know, "So how's it going with so-and-so?" And she, you know, she said, "Well, we're not together anymore." And I was like, "Okay, let's have to, what do I do here? Okay, quick, you know, say something, say the right thing immediately." And it wasn't a year later that we were married.
It must be really awkward in a way to start developing a relationship with someone when you're working with them on a movie.
Right.
Do you try to keep it quiet from everybody on
Yeah,
set?
You try to do that whole thing. And then there's also the whole kind of, you know, tabloid-level interest in what you do. And so you kind of have, you spend a lot of time, you know, running through Central Park, you know, away from photographers and just bizarre stuff. And you stop and go, why am I doing this? Why do I even care?
You actually wrote a really funny article in Esquire magazine about what it was like to get married with all the paparazzi and all the tabloids wanting to be part of the wedding and you wanting to keep them out.
Well, I had the I had the good luck to have Michael Pollan as my brother-in-law, who's the executive editor at Harper's and a terrific writer. And just to kind of backtrack and set it up, we got married at this little inn in Vermont. And I've always understood that, you know, if people in the public eye get married and they have, you know, 14 elephants and, you know, camels and, you know, people, you know, you swing up on a golden, chandelier and, you know, and it costs $500,000, there's a certain amount of spectacle there, and you expect it to get some kind of coverage, and it would be hypocritical at that point to say, well, okay, leave us alone, you know.
It's just a little personal event.
But this was like 40 people at an inn in Arlington, Vermont,
yeah.
And, you know, we literally had a record player, and we, you know, rolled back the rugs, and we had, like, jug wine and beer, you know. It was a pretty low-key deal. So when this giant contingent of the tabloid press showed up and demanded that their rights be served and that they get to, you know, they get to cover the event on behalf of our fans, I immediately said, well, anyone who would sanction this, I'm happily, you know, I won't take their money anymore. They can keep their $7. I don't need them. And it just was so hilarious. I mean, if it was just a little intrusive, I think I would have been more angry, but it was so kind of biblical. It was just insane.
Would you have helicopters?
Well, there were helicopters. There was one group of photographers that were trying to find a llama suit because there were llamas on the grounds of this inn, and they thought if they put on a llama suit, they could infiltrate. There were, these helicopters. There were people. They had the National Enquirer had their central command in the same hotel that where we spent our first night of marriage, you know. It was just insane. We were checking for parabolic microphones. It became so comic. We went down to, on our honeymoon, down to the Caribbean, and we had this terrific villa on the water, and we arrived at night, and I'll never forget the morning that I woke up, and there was these big louvered windows, and I opened them up, you know, to look at the view, and there were three boats 50 feet offshore with like 500-millimeter lenses, you know, pointed at us. And we went, this is surreal. And we went to Martha's Vineyard, and because we decided to escape that, and we went to Martha's Vineyard, and a frogman literally came out of the water and finally got the photograph that they've been trying to get. And then the capper to the whole thing was that we literally got bad reviews, that magazines like People and whatnot just savaged our wedding, just kind of... not only said, how dare you, you know, try to get married and not have us be part of it, but also we hear it really sucked. We hear it was terrible, you know, and this projection, it was so clear, it was so adolescent, it was so, you know, this is just the most insane teenage projection that I've ever seen. And I sat back and I said, I don't even know how you rebut this, or whether you want to, or how you respond to it. And I was talking to Michael about it, and he said, write it. Just write it down, because someone will want to hear it. And so it became this piece.
Well, something that interested me in the story, apparently when People magazine said, you know, if you give us the exclusive, you know, blah, blah,
right.
blah.
They said, they offered us the Bert and Lonnie deal. and we now see what happens when you take the Bert and Lonnie deal.
Well, what happens?
Well, you become partners. Well, you become partners with the media in the most private element of your life. And so, you know, with those people, with Bert and Lonnie, who I don't know, and I perhaps shouldn't talk about them or be perceived to be making a judgment, because I'm not really. But, I mean, something's going on there. I mean, why else would you play this out to that extent in the press, the destruction of their marriage, if certain deals weren't made along the line? And you just can't make, you've got to, you know, I think the reason that I'm so happy is that I was always able to kind of keep a separation there. And sometimes it's difficult, and sometimes nasty things are said about you, and so, you know, whatever, but you have to kind of go, well, that's not real. I have to keep my world in some ways as small as possible.
It's part of the deal that if you let in a magazine and give them exclusive rights, they'll give you a good review for the wedding.
Basically,
and if you don't let them in, all bets are off.
That's essentially what happened, yeah. And like I said, the other thing that happens, I mean, like it really does become so juvenile and silly. I mean, to this day, I have, you know, back and forth with these people. I think currently I'm divorced in the latest Globe, And, you know, they call you and they say, you care to rebut this? And you say, no, read my lips. I'm not going to get in any confirmation denial relationship with you. I mean, what's the point? If I deny it, you'll characterize it as a, you know, this denial and you'll wrap it up. And I mean, you know, it's like these things they do on A Current Affair where they videotape someone, and because nothing was said, what they do is they run it in slow motion so that it looks suspicious and nasty no matter what you do. It's just so insane that to even become a party to it is just a waste of your time.
I love on those shows how they keep, since they only have like 3 inches of footage, they keep rerunning it over and over. Right.
And it's always that really slow motion
like
thing with furtive little eye glance, you know. Taking out the trash, taking out the trash look like dumping bodies off the Brooklyn Bridge.
My guest is Michael J. Fox. He stars in the new romantic comedy For Love or Money. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael J. Fox. I want to ask you about Casualties of War, the film set in Vietnam, where you star with Sean Penn, and the platoon goes on this mission, and he basically kidnaps a young Vietnamese woman, and midway through the mission, there's a gang rape that your character refuses to participate mm-hmm. in, and you try to save her. I'm interested in what it was like for you to work with Sean Penn, because you appear to be such different kinds of actors, and one would mm-hmm. think that you have really different approaches to, you know, how you prepare for a scene and what you're like in a scene when
right.
When you're shooting. So I'm wondering if there was anything that clashed about that, or...
Well, there was actually no clash, but there was complete and total difference in the way we work.
Yeah.
When we finished the movie, and we went out for dinner in Bangkok, and I gave Sean a gift, and there was a card, and I hope you won't mind me saying this, but on the card I had written, Sean, I can't say that it was a pleasure, but it was certainly a privilege, which is the way I felt about it. Sean and I have completely different approaches to the way we work, and I think that Sean is a tremendous actor with an amazing energy. And when we met originally and talked about doing the film together, you know, we're very open, and we kind of said what we were going to do. And Sean, as much as said, I am this guy. From the moment I get on the plane, I am this guy. And I said, I'm not, you know. So we kind of agreed to go our own ways in that way. And so that when we shot the film, and much has been made of this, but it actually was like a non-event. We, very little outside of working, talked very little and discussed what we were doing very little because it was counterproductive. There was mm-hmm. no sense in doing it. I like to work from the story out. From the story in to the character. And Sean prefers to look at it the other way. Having said that, what's really great about the way Sean worked is that he never once impinged upon anything, any choice I made with the way he did his work, which is to say, even though we played enemies, his approach to that is have minimal contact. A kind of an irresponsible approach to that style of work would be to be intrusive with my process in the way that his character might. And that would be irresponsible, and that I would, you know, go like this and say, wait a minute, you know, that's not the way it's going to work, and we've got to make some changes here. But it was never like that. Sean did his work, and I did my work, and I think that it worked well.
I have a friend who likes to say that whole film kind of takes place on your face, because as the drama unfolds, as your character is exposed to all these horrors, your character is just changing and reacting to what he sees. Mm-hmm. And what registers on your face is kind of crucial to right. what happens visually in the film. And I was wondering how conscious you were of that, and if it put, you know, different demands on you than anything you had done before.
Yeah, it was a very demanding film in that way. And again, you know, with comedy... I am most comfortable with comedy, and I think it's also because I have a real technical understanding of comedy. I mean, comedy, you can break it down. You can say, you know, you say things in threes, they're funny. If you hit the K, it's funny. Cucumber is funny. Certain things are funny. Dramatic moments and dramatic punchlines, if you will, are much more elusive, and it's much more just what happens. So you have to... I don't have a real technique for that. The only thing that I can do is be available to what's happening. the great thing about Casualties of War was, from a performance point of view, was that the environment was such, and the things that were being acted out were such that that stuff was very available. I mean, this girl screaming was, I think, heightened by the fact that it was in Vietnamese and that we were all hot. It was 120 degrees. A lot of us were dysenteric. We were homesick. We had bites on us and welts. We had gone through basic training. We had done all these things. And so in that way, it was a real emotional experience. I found that when I felt the compulsion to act, I stifled it. I said, forget about it. I don't want to do that. Sean's performance, and rightly so, was a very outward and a very kind of forceful performance. And I thought that what Erickson should be is very quiet and very confused. He's not out there to push any agenda. He doesn't have an agenda. His agenda is just to get through this. He didn't know what to expect. He thought he was going on a camping trip. He just, you know, got a thing in the mail, said get on a plane and, you know, do this thing. And it's just, so I just thought, just sit back and let this stuff happen. And I think that it did, you know.
Well, one last question. Do you feel like you learned different things about yourself working with dramatic directors like Paul Schrader and Brian De Palma? About yourself as an actor.
I think that it's definitely those experiences were learning experiences for me as an actor. I think that also, given where they fell in my life, they were learning experiences for me as a person. I mean, I had never been exposed to anyone like Paul Schrader in my life, and I learned a lot about art and about acting and about life from him, and Brian as well. By the same token, I think I learn a lot about myself as an actor and as a filmmaker, in a sense, and a potential filmmaker in terms of directing, from Bob Zemeckis and from... you know, from Michael Caton Jones and Jonathan Lynn, who I just worked with as well. Just looking at the dramatic side isn't getting the entirety of any fact or any situation. That the comedic side can be as important and as fruitful if you explore it.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Michael J. Fox stars in the new movie For Love or Money. It opens this Friday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.